Welcome to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. On both podcasts this week, joining me will be one of our favorite special guests, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey is editor and publisher at Laissez-Faire Books, and we'll be talking to him about his most recent book. And on both podcasts this week, I'll be talking about the topics of inflation and deflation, and I'll be examining what's going on in a couple countries around the world. In the country of Argentina, inflation has taken hold. In 2014, the inflation rate exceeded 40%. And of course, many of you are familiar with what's going on in Greece. For the past 7 years in Greece, they've been experiencing what can only be described as a deflationary depression. And we'll ask the question, how can both of these economic outcomes be occurring at the same time on the same planet? And could either of those outcomes happen here? Which is most likely, and what might you do to protect yourself? So today, we'll be talking a bit about some of the inflation and deflation definitions. And on the second podcast this week, I'll be giving you some practical hands-on things to consider. If you've not yet requested our Investors Discovery Kit, I'd encourage you to do so by visiting the website, investingapproach.com. The Investors Discovery Kit is free. We'll be glad to mail it to you. Just let us know your name and where you'd like us to mail it, and we will get it to you as a free educational resource. Again, the website is investingapproach.com. I'm pleased to have back on Everything Financial Radio returning guest, Mr. Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey's most recent book is titled Bit by Bit. We'll talk to him about that. He is also the editor of Laissez-Faire Books, and he's the director of digital development at the Foundation for Economic Education. And Jeffrey, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Jeffrey, tell the listeners about the premise of your book, Bit by Bit.
Well, the premise of it is that we're living in extraordinary times that are unleashing human liberty and opportunities for communication and contact and production and labor all over the world in a way that fundamentally affects our political relationships with the government. And it's a very optimistic book, looking forward to a world of individualism and freedom as brought to us not through the usual channels of politics or even through education or ideological agitation, but through brilliant technological innovation. I'm convinced that this is the way forward for everybody who loves human liberty.
So, Jeffrey, you made a statement that these emerging technologies affect our political relationship with government. Explain.
Yes, and this gets us to the foundation of political philosophy in a way. You know, what is the state? What does it do? What are its opportunities? What are its limits? And when you look at the state as a structure, just as an institution, as something we erected, there's the promise that was that the state was going to bring us progress, that the specialized sort of management of the social order that we saw beginning of the 20th century would make us healthier, happier, wiser, you know, more prosperous. And I think now that we're in the 21st century, it's becoming increasingly obvious that that is not true. And a lot of the technologies that we've seen emerge over the last 20 years, and really in particular over the last five, have really been workarounds to this huge regulatory structure that has been erected in our times, that has really ended up making us poorer than we otherwise be and caused, you know, just immense and ongoing problems for every enterprising person in the world, essentially. So the peer-to-peer technologies that we're so often use on our smartphones and in the digital world are designed to get around these problems, and they're really being successful. So, you know, why is this? Why am I so anxious to pit, you know, this sort of P2P revolution against the sort of status quo? The reason is this. The state is in many ways constrained by two fundamental factors of its existence. The first one is that it always must operate on geographically constrained boundaries. So the state is always juridically circumscribed by geography. So the United States ultimately can only control the United States. Spain can only control Spain, and so on. But the digital world is naturally and inevitably globalized. It doesn't recognize the existence of any nation states as such. It considers all people in the world to be potential cooperators in building civilization. So, you know, it has no regard for boundaries and borders. So these are fundamentally conflicting modes of operation between the digital world and the government. The second thing is that the government's only real power in this world is coercive. It can coerce our bodies and take our property and control the physical world. That's its core sort of competence, if you want to call it that. But the digital world is necessarily, you know, evades the constraints of the physical world. It's weightless and spaceless and moves, you know, with lightning speed and is not subject to the same kind of levels of control that, say, heavy machinery is or agriculture. That's why we call it the digital age. You know, under the age of agriculture, you know, the state could control land. In the capitalist age of heavy machinery, the state can target individual entrepreneurs. There's always insofar as we're only working in the physical world, there's a central point of failure. You know, essentially the government's always going to be in charge. But once you sort of move the great productive machinery of the social order into the digital space, it tends to evade the attempts by the nation state to control it for both those reasons I mentioned. First, that the state is constrained by geography, and second, that it's limited to controlling the physical property. So the digital world then comes again into conflict with traditional political structures. And that's why I say it's a fundamental challenge to the way we've been, you know, managing our lives for the last 100 years or so, or maybe thousands of years.
Well, if you're just joining us, we are chatting with Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, who is the author of Bit by Bit. He's also the editor at Laissez-Faire Books, and he is the director of digital development at the Foundation for Economic Education. Jeffrey, you made a comment that these emerging technologies have kind of really evolved as a way to work around regulation. Interesting thought occurred to me. Is it the regulation that is the catalyst for these emerging technologies, or were we going to see them anyway, regardless of the regulation?
No, I was both, right? I mean, so I think what happened here is if you look back at the late 19th century, we were seeing great progress. We were largely laissez-faire. There was no income tax. There was no central bank. There were no regulations on schools, medicine, law, anything, you know? And then at the turn of the 20th century, the ruling class erected this massive apparatus of control. You know, they started gigantic global wars. They started regulating, you know, all food and medicine and law and professions, and created central banks and income taxes. So you basically, over the course of 100 years, it's gotten to the point that you can't move. You can't make any money. You can't make any decisions on your own. Everything is intermediated by the state. So that sets up a real frustrating situation because, you know, there's no possibility for innovation under these conditions. The world becomes a static place. Whereas free enterprise is always on the move, always creating things, thinking of new ideas, trying new things, looking for ways to test new ideas to push the limits. So yes, so many of the enterprises that are going on today are challenging these structures, you know, fundamentally. A good example I can think of, just in case the listeners are getting frustrated with the sheer abstraction of my comments here, is something like Airbnb. Airbnb allows you to rent out a home in your house that is otherwise being unused to anybody in the world who happens to be traveling through, and for you to become basically a hotel for a couple of days, you know, and make some money. So you're using unused resources. And the way you do this is through a peer-to-peer contact and reputation-based system without the sort of intermediation of a government. Well, that sounds reasonable, except that, you know, that is fundamentally in conflict with things like zoning laws, with public accommodations laws, with you know, vast amounts of state, local, and national regulatory structures. And yet everybody loves it. You know, it works beautifully. and people use Airbnb all the time now. And it's challenging the sort of hotel monopoly and in this beautiful way. And the wonderful thing about this is that it's growing at such a pace and benefiting so many people that it becomes very difficult for the regulators and the bureaucrats to just come in and try to shut it down. They tried to do this to Airbnb in New York and were just incredibly unsuccessful. People are looking at this going, hey, look, guys, we've got a housing shortage around here. I can never get a hotel in New York. Everything's ridiculously expensive. Airbnb is providing a solution to my problem. So you politicians and regulators and bureaucrats out there better not intervene. And ultimately, the government had to back down. And we're seeing this not just in hotel accommodations, but in transportation and in money and in office space and the markets for goods and services. Everything is moving towards this peer-to-peer world, and I think it's raising a real challenge. You know, what is the role of the state going forward? And the peer-to-peer revolution really asks us to sort of deal with that fundamental question.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there in this segment. We are chatting with Mr. Jeffrey Tucker, author of Bit by Bit. I'll continue my conversation with Mr. Jeffrey Tucker on the second podcast this week. In this segment, I want to talk about some things going on economically in some countries around the world and talk about which outcome might be most likely here in the United States, and even more importantly, talk about what that might mean for you and your nest egg. And I'll tell you what I mean. In fact, if you think about it, it's pretty ironic when you take a look at what's going on in the country of Greece. If you're a regular listener to the Everything Financial Radio program, we talked about what was going on in Greece just a couple of weeks ago. It's likely now that the country of Greece will leave the euro. One of the reasons that they'll leave the euro we'll explain in some greater detail as this segment progresses. But essentially, when Greece is in the euro, they don't have the ability to print money. And if you can't print money, there's only two ways to deal with your budget deficit and your debt excesses. You can either raise taxes or you can cut spending. But printing money is not an option. And when debt levels reach a certain point, to the point that they're unsustainable, deflation becomes the overwhelming economic trend. And deflation is frankly very ugly. If you want to think about deflation and want an example that you're undoubtedly familiar with, think about the United States during the Great Depression in the 1930s. That was a deflationary time frame. In a deflationary environment, stocks don't do well. Stocks crash. In a deflationary environment, unemployment is very high. There's a lot of economic pain. That was the United States in the 1930s. That is Greece today. Greece has youth unemployment in the 60% range, and they've seen their economy contract every year for the last 7 years. By contrast, when you take a look at what's going on in the country of Argentina, Argentina can print money. In fact, they've done just that because they've defaulted on debt a couple times. The policymakers in Argentina have three choices to deal with their deficits and debt excesses. They can either raise taxes, cut spending, or print money, and they've decided to print money. In fact, in 2014, the inflation rate in Argentina hit 40%. That makes Argentina one of the countries in the world with the highest inflation rate. In fact, there was a piece on Business Insider this past week that I thought was interesting. There was an ad advertising a Volvo in Argentina in 2001, and the cost of the Volvo was 12,500 pesos. There was an ad advertising a Samsung Galaxy, the cell phone, the mobile phone that likely many of you have, and the cost of that in 2015 is a little over 15,000 pesos. So about the same price 14 years later as you'd have paid for a Volvo 14 years previously. Argentina is suffering from inflation. So how can both of these economic trends occur at the same time on the same planet? And what's most likely to happen here and why? Well, inflation is simply defined as an expansion of the money supply. the money supply expands. There's more money out there, and obviously abundance does not create value. Scarcity creates value. And when money is abundant because they printed more of it, one of the symptoms is rising prices. One of the simplest definitions of inflation, although it's not all that accurate, is too much money chasing too few goods and services. Deflation is the polar opposite of inflation. Deflation is a contraction of the money supply. When the money supply contracts, one of the symptoms is falling prices. Now, if you've been a long-time listener to the program, you may have heard this statistic before, but for new listeners, it's really important to understand this fact. Over 95% of money today is debt. Less than 5% is actual currency, the bills and the coins that we all carry around. 95% of all money is debt. So debt levels and the money supply and whether we get inflation or deflation are very closely related. When debt levels rise to unsustainable levels, debts go unpaid. And when debts go unpaid, money disappears from the financial system, and the natural economic trend to emerge is deflation. You just need to think back to what happened during the financial crisis. Prior to the financial crisis, there were a lot of very inventive bankers making very unique loans and on mortgages, on homes. You could have no money down and you would be able to buy a house. You might be able to have a mortgage that would negatively amortize, meaning that as time went on, the balance on your loan would grow. It was very, very easy to get a loan. And as a result, we saw housing prices just go through the roof. They went up about 50% over a three-year time frame nationally on average. And then one of the causes of the financial crisis was that there was simply too much debt to be paid. So what happened? Well, when someone didn't pay a debt and gave the house back to the bank to satisfy the mortgage, the banker saw money disappear from their balance sheet. If they loan Mr. Jones $100,000 to buy a house, Mr. Jones decides he doesn't want to make the payments on the house anymore and gives the house back to the bank, and the bank sells the house for $60,000, that's $40,000 of money that disappeared. The money supply contracted, and deflation is the ultimate result. So what happened was the Federal Reserve started to print money. They wanted to add money to the system at least as fast as money was disappearing from the system to avoid deflation. Now, when you look at government debt, there's three choices to deal with government debt, as I stated. You can cut taxes, you can cut spending, you can raise taxes, or you can print money. Argentina has been printing money, so they have massive inflation. Greece has not had that option. They've cut spending, they've implemented tax increases, and the result in Greece is a deflationary environment. So, what does that mean for you and your nest egg? Are we going to see inflation? Are we going to see deflation? And what asset classes perform best in each economic environment? You won't want to miss the second podcast of this week. I'll be continuing my conversation with Jeffrey Tucker, and we'll talk about which asset classes are likely going to perform best moving ahead, given the economic trend that will likely be prevalent in our view. So you won't want to miss the second podcast of the week. If you know someone that's planning for retirement or managing a nest egg, you might have them check it out as well. We have the podcast posted at the iTunes store. They are free. You just have to search under Everything Financial Radio, and you can listen in anytime you'd like. Talk to you again in just a couple days. Bye.